Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, and on this ID the Future podcast, we have back on the show with us Dennis Wagner, Executive Director of the Access Research Network, talking to us about ARN's Top 10 Darwin and Design Science Stories for 2010. So Dennis, thanks for coming back on the show with us.
It's always a pleasure, Casey.
Well, as we mentioned in the first podcast, every year, Access Research Network, or ARN.org, provides a service to the whole ID community by essentially cataloging what they believe are the top 10 Darwin and Design science stories for the year. And we do a podcast like this each year with Dennis Wagner from the ARN and talk about what are some of the scientific accomplishments that have come out in the last year that support intelligent design or challenge Darwinian evolution. And this is always a lot of fun to talk about. In the last podcast, we talked about the five honorable mention stories from 2010, and now we're going to get into the official top 10 stories. So the number 10 story, Dennis, dealt with fruit flies and whether or not they provide evidence for Darwinian evolution. What can you tell us about this story about fruit flies?
Well, fruit flies are favorite among geneticists because their life cycles are so short, they can do a lot of experimentation over a short period of time. And they've done over 600 generations, I guess, of experiments on fruit flies, exposing them to radiation and see what kind of mutations happen, those kinds of things. But this year, there was a report that came out in the September 30th issue of Nature. A doctoral student, Molly Burke, compared the experimental flies with a control group on a genome-wide basis. And this was significant because it's the first time that such a study of sexually reproducing species has ever been done. And for decades, most researchers have assumed that sexual species evolve the same way as single-celled bacteria do. A genetic mutation sweeps through the population and quickly becomes fixed on a particular portion of the DNA, and that is passed on through heredity. But the UCI work shows that when sex is involved, it's far more complicated. They quoted in the article that this research really upends the dominant paradigm about how species evolve. For the empirical work is worth noting on two counts here. First, we are considering a mechanism that is central to Darwinian evolution. Positive natural selection of heritable variation is the key, we're told, to understanding how descent with modification occurred, according to Darwinian theory. However, the first set of real empirical data relating to sexually reproducing species does not conform as we thought. And so this is really a key concept of how Darwinian evolution is supposed to happen, and we're not seeing it in empirical evidence.
And Dennis, the number 9 story is in a similar vein in that it also challenged the importance of natural selection as a driving force of evolution. And of course, if we take high school biology, we're always taught that the primary driving force of adaptive change is natural selection. But this paper that you cite from Biology Letters from January in 2010 claimed that natural selection or competition is not necessarily the driving force. What can you tell us about this paper?
Again, it was another shocking empirical evidence for the Darwinian theory in that it's always been stated that competition among species is what drives biodiversity or the wide diversity of life that we find. But basically, the conclusion out of this paper was that biodiversity on Earth has grown out of expansion, not competition. And so it's having a new place to expand into that is causing the biodiversity, not competition and natural selection. So that's just a radically new concept. And I think the Darwinists, again, have to go back to the drawing board and figure out what's going on here because this data does not seem to fit their theory.
Number 8 story is one that is an ongoing story that over the last 3, 4, 5 years, the ID movement has been following very closely, and that is the continuous demise of the junk DNA paradigm for genomics. Basically, the claim that non-coding DNA is useless genetic junk. Sometimes I feel like the only person who really still holds on to that idea is P.Z. Myers. But in any case, you cite a lot of scientific papers in your number 8 story, which shows function for junk DNA. Many of our listeners of ID the Future are very familiar with this issue and know how much evidence has come out just in the past year. And of course, there have been many other papers in previous years that have discovered function for non-coding DNA. But what can you tell us about the functions that have been discovered for so-called junk DNA in 2010?
Well, one of the surprising things that's come out of all the genome sequencing projects is the fact that whether it's a simple worm with only 1,000 cells or a human being that can have 30 to 100 trillion cells. What we find out is they all have about the same range of approximately 20,000 protein-coding genes. And so that's got scientists looking at what accounts for this morphological difference that we're seeing if it's not the number of genes. You know, that's quite a big difference, and I think we went into the genome sequencing assuming that the simpler organisms would have fewer genes and the more complex would have more. And it turns out that the difference is a lot of times in what the evolutionists call junk DNA, because they believe it was leftover vestiges, because we haven't been able to understand the function of these, and so they felt that this area of the DNA was leftover vestiges from our evolutionary past. But surprisingly, they're finding more and more function for these areas, and a lot of time it's an encoding function that influences how the genes themselves get expressed. And there were five or six different articles that came out along this same area that had to do with the junk DNA, junk RNA and fruit flies, the encoding functions of microRNAs, host functions of the retrotransposons distributed across the human chromosomes. We're finding that a lot of these things, again, have a role in how the gene gets expressed. And so this whole idea of junk DNA is rapidly disappearing, and that's supported by the numerous science articles that were published this year.
The number seven story is an amusing one, and we've talked about this before, actually, before the podcast started, Dennis, how in the last few years we've seen increasing amounts of what you would call hype, evolutionists trying to hype their experiments and their research findings to the public and to the media. And this year, 2010, was no exception. We saw some wonderful examples of overhyped research findings. In particular, one finding that was overhyped was the claim that Craig Venter and his team had created artificial life or synthetic life. And if you looked in some news story headlines earlier this year, you would actually find the claim that they had produced artificial life in the lab. Is that claim true? And if it's not true, what really happened?
Well, the first thing I like to point out on things like this, similar to Stanley Miller's experiment or other things, is, you know, it takes a mind to engineer these situations, and they take that situation and say, therefore, we've now found a pathway in which nature could have done this by itself. You know, if you look at the situation, they had 20 skilled scientists working for a decade with $40 million of funding, and they didn't really even create life. They've only recreated life or mimicked life because they started with a bunch of building blocks for that part. So the first point that seems to be missed in all this is it took intelligent design to even do this experiment, and yet they think this is some kind of evidence for nature being able to do it on its own. There were several scientists who came out quickly and spoke out against this overhype, as you call it, and I think that's a real healthy sign that, you know, not everybody is getting on the bandwagon on these types of things. I just wanted to read one to you here from Mei-Wan Ho, who summarized the situation, saying, clearly the scientists have not created life or the bacterial cell. There is a yawning chasm in the physics and chemistry of the living state that the team hasn't even begun to address, let alone bridge. They did not create the genome that was used to transform the bacteria cell, only copying it from another species, adding a watermark for identification, and no doubt for staking their claim to a synthetic genome. This synthetic genome was not even made from scratch, but cobbled together from pieces found in a catalog and then transplanted into the cells of the recipient bacterium species, using an antibiotic to select for cells that have accepted the artificial chromosome and allow them to grow. And so, as I said, they've just cobbled together something from a catalog of parts. Boston University bioengineer James Collin called the work an important advance in our ability to re-engineer organisms, but not to make life from scratch. He went on to say, frankly, scientists don't even know enough about biology to create life. So, we still got a long way to go just to understand life, let alone make a claim that we've been able to recreate synthetic life.
At best, what they did was intelligently designed plagiarism, in that they just copied pre-existing genetic code that they know works in bacteria and plugged it in, and lo and behold, it worked. It is an accomplishment, but they certainly didn't create synthetic life or artificial life.
Right.
Dennis, if you don't mind, I'm going to tell the number six science story from 2010. Would you mind that?
Well, I think that's appropriate because you reported a lot on that this year, and I think that was the source of our information for item number six. So go ahead, Casey, take it away.
Well, thank you, Dennis. And I think that some of our listeners on ID the Future will be familiar with this story because we've talked about it over the last couple months a little bit. But in early 2010, there was a discovery of tetrapod tracks in Poland that were about 397 million years old. And the discoverers felt fairly confident that these were, in fact, the tracks of tetrapod or four-limbed vertebrates, because not only were there the footprints, but the footprints had well-defined digits. And this was a very clear sign that they were dealing with actual tracks from four-legged vertebrate organisms. So why were these interesting? Well, they're interesting because previously, before this, the earliest known tetrapods came from about 365 million years ago, and the alleged fish ancestors of tetrapods lived around, say, 385, 390 million years ago. And then we have Tiktaalik, which has been widely touted by the Darwin lobby as an alleged transitional form between fish and tetrapods. And Tiktaalik is found right around 375 million years ago. And this has been widely touted as a confirmed prediction that Tiktaalik is a so-called transitional form and that its stratigraphic placement in the fossil record between the earliest known tetrapods and the alleged fish ancestors of tetrapods is a nice, neat, confirmed prediction of evolutionary theory. As a matter of fact, we've seen the stratigraphic placement of Tiktaalik touted by the Darwin lobby in some very prestigious venues as one of their new favorite pieces of evidence for macroevolution. In the 2007 Judgment Day Intelligent Design on Trial PBS documentary, or perhaps you might say mockumentary, they touted Tiktaalik as sort of the rhetorical climax of the entire documentary as evidence for macroevolution. There's also the 2008 National Academy of Sciences booklet Science, Evolution, and Creationism, which devoted a number of pages to discussing Tiktaalik and its stratigraphic placement in the fossil record as one of the NAS's, the National Academy of Sciences, top pieces of evidence for macroevolution. And of course, Jerry Coyne in his book Why Evolution is True calls the stratigraphic placement of Tiktaalik supposedly between fish and the appearance of tetrapods as one of the most compelling predictions of evolutionary theory that he's aware of.
It also appeared in the Nature booklet, 15 Evolutionary Gems. It was their number two gem. So, you know, they continue to hold this up as one of the great icons of evolution.
Well, I think you're right, Dennis. I think it's becoming an icon of evolution, and it's very obvious that the Darwin lobby has invested quite a bit of rhetorical capital in the supposedly predicted stratigraphic location of Tiktaalik. But of course, that whole prediction fell apart when these tetrapod tracks were discovered in Poland in early 2010 that were dated to 397 million years ago, about 20 million years older than Tiktaalik. So basically you have tetrapods appearing before their supposed ancestor, the so-called transitional form Tiktaalik. So obviously Tiktaalik is no longer a direct transitional form to tetrapods if it comes 20 million years after these tetrapod tracks. Now, some people will continue to say that Tiktaalik is sort of a transitional form in the squishy, wishy-washy sense, and that maybe it has some features that appear transitional between fish and tetrapods, and that's another debatable issue. And so they'll say, even if it was not an actual transitional form, maybe perhaps it is representative of what a transitional form might have looked like. They'll say that on those grounds, they will still call it a transitional form, even if it's not in the right place in the fossil record. And okay, fine. But the bottom line is that the Darwin lobby, as we've just discussed, has made quite a big deal about the supposedly predicted stratigraphic placement of Tiktaalik as a supposed transitional form in the fossil record. And that prediction fell apart when we have now discovered tetrapod tracks that predate Tiktaalik by about 20 million years.
So, Casey, do you think Nature is going to republish their booklet and call it the 14 Evolutionary Gems and delete number two?
Well, I wouldn't count on it, Dennis. One of the things that's been interesting in this whole episode is how few people from the evolutionary community have been willing to recognize that this prediction, not just that it was made, but that it was also overturned. The only person I can think of that actually has recognized that this prediction has been proven false is Henry G., an editor at Nature, who, of course, did it while mocking the so-called creationists. But at the same time, I think it's significant that the response to the Darwin lobby, to folks like
like me or David Tyler of Access Research Network, who discussed the fact that this prediction was made and that now it's been overturned, we were really met with a lot of harsh criticism. In particular, we were told by a number of folks, P.Z. Myers comes to mind, that we just don't understand how the scientific process works, that this is good that paleontologists are discovering new fossils and are expanding our knowledge of the fossil record, and this is not bad for evolution. And I agree with them that it's great that paleontologists are expanding our knowledge of the fossil record. Unfortunately, what many folks were unwilling to do was recognize that this prediction had been made, that Tiktaalik was supposedly right in this little pocket of time between the appearance of tetrapods and their supposed fish ancestors, and that that prediction was now overturned by the discovery of these tracks. And it kind of turned into a shoot the messenger kind of situation where the Darwin lobbyists wanted to rewrite history and pretend that this prediction had never been made in the first place in order to call us ID guys ignorant of the way the scientific method works. Well, I guess that's kind of what you get for standing up for the truth. Well, Dennis, I think that we are running out of time here on the second podcast, but we're going to return for more on ID the Future as we discuss the top five Darwin and Design science stories from 2010. I'm Casey Luskin. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.